on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial President, Portfolio Manager Steve Peasley.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Thursday edition of InvestTalk. It's April 23rd, 2015. And because it's April 23rd, 2015, I have Justin Klein with me here today.
How's it going, Steve?
Good. Thanks for coming.
Just good. Not great. We have our event coming up on Saturday, and it's going to be exciting. You're not excited about
excited?
It?
Excited? I'm looking forward to the information. I think it's pretty interesting information. I think people get a lot out of it. I don't know. I do them so often. Excitement's not really the word. I do like doing them. I enjoy them. I don't know. When you get old, things don't get exciting anymore.
I know you're excited to get on that plane.
I hate that flying stuff. Welcome to a Thursday edition, everybody. This is above average investing for the average investor. How do you become above average? How do you become an above average investor? Well, you don't make average investor mistakes. That's one way. One of the most repeated Warren Buffett quotes says, the most repeated mistake is the rule number one, never lose money. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. Now, that's pretty tough to follow, by the way. Remember, he loses money, too. But it depends on your time frame, doesn't it? I mean, he has, you know, when the market, there was a couple of years where his Berkshire Hathaway positions went down. The value of Berkshire Hathaway went down for a couple of years. But then on the long run, he's always outperformed. He's done very, very well. One of the reasons he just uses leverage, which you pointed out some time ago, Justin.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a lot of businesses are cyclical. So if you go into recession, he's not immune to recessions either.
So all investors, all of us are going to lose money at one time or another. You're going to make decisions that don't pan out. You're going to have periods of time where the market is not cooperating with you. It's making your mistakes small, keeping them small, and understanding the pulls and pushes and tugs and on the market, economically speaking, and on stock prices, valuations. There's just so many things to watch that you are going to make mistakes. It's just the way it is.
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah, you just can't help it. As long as we're dredging up old chestnuts like rule number one of Warren Buffett's, how about one from Ben Franklin? An investment is knowledge. An investment in knowledge pays the most interest. Well, that's old Ben Franklin. He had a lot of those sayings. Penny earned is a penny saved. Is that really true?
You got to save it to earn to really save it. I mean, I can earn a penny and spend it. That's not really saved, is it?
Well, in this one, it's spend a little money on education, spend a little time on education, and you'll help reduce some of your mistakes. That's what he's talking about. With that, I lead into a plug for our Saturday Morning Wealth Conference coming up day after tomorrow, the San Jose Hyatt House. It's 9 to 12 in the morning, 9 to noon. And we ask you to invest $45 in 3 hours to gather some information that can give you an edge.
And we don't make money off this or anything.
Oh,
no.
Is just trying
to recoup a little bit of our costs.
Yeah, just trying to cover maybe half our costs even.
Yeah.
Not even.
Yeah.
Not even. Maybe the food.
Exactly.
Anyway, so we hope you'll be there. We want you to be there. You know, we'll give you some really good information. Global value investing, finding opportunities in foreign, domestic, and emerging markets. And we're going to talk a little bit about frontier markets, too. Okay, it's fine to recommend expanding your horizons to foreign markets, but there are pitfalls that are very clear in these foreign markets. And we're going to talk about what to watch out for.
Yeah, because that's the important part, is understanding the risks when you're going abroad, but also that you need to look abroad many times throughout your investment horizon to find good values, because sometimes the good values aren't necessarily here in America, and we're going to tell you kind of why that is and where the better values are.
Yeah, we're going to talk about ADRs, and if you don't know what those are, we're going to explain them to you. ETF, we're going to give you an ETF, foreign ETF list of ETFs that you can use or at least study. How to value foreign stocks compared to domestic, how to manage political and currency risks, how to factor in global economic changes like quantitative easing. There are issues we're going to discuss at this Saturday morning's wealth conference on at the San Jose Hyatt House that we don't talk about on the radio because we don't have the time. We can't show you things on the radio. We really can't. So I hope you spend the time with us. You can sign up right now by going to investtalk.com. So please sign up. Here on InvestTalk, we try to answer your questions within 24 hours with our 24-hour listener line. Or you can talk to us live Monday through Friday. We're live right now, 4 to 5 Pacific time. The number is 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Steve and Justin. This is Jason from Buffalo, New York. I have a fairly basic question, but I'd like to hear the answer. There's a lot of talk from the Fed about raising interest rates, and there's been a lot of talk about what that would do to the economy. But my kind of basic question was, I thought, well, why does the Fed really want to raise interest rates in the first place? I get that it's a more normal environment if interest rates are higher, but why is that preferable? Thank you.
Actually, that's a very good question.
Very good.
It really is. And I think we both should take a stab at it, Justin. The reason why the Fed wants to get the rates to what we call normalization or normal rates, or would like to at least have them up a little bit, is so they can fight the next recession. With them being so low, it makes it very difficult for them to use the fiscal policy that they have to reduce rates to stimulate growth, because it already really, they're at zero now.
Yeah, it's pretty much, yeah, that's the way I would explain it as well. They have to have bullets in their gun. They want to have bullets in their gun to fire if you hit a recession. Now, the biggest issue is, are they going to cause a recession by raising those interest rates?
Now, that is a valid point, too.
Are they going to? Which one's going to come first? Are they going to start raising interest rates and have to turn right back around very quickly? You know, their hope is to, what they're trying to do is say, okay, we're going to raise interest rates, but it's going to be very slow. It's going to be, okay, a quarter point here, maybe wait 6 months, maybe even a year, go to, you know, 0.5%. Then go eventually, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the line, that's when they hope to get to somewhere normal range, which is what, 3, 3.5% on the Fed funds rate. And we're far, far from that right now.
Yeah, I don't see them making any dramatic changes. Even if they start to raise them, I think they may start and stop, you know, very fast.
Yeah.
So, but that's why, that's basically why they need those bullets, as Justin said, in their gun to fire at a recession when it does come.
And they don't want to be seen as, you know, Japan. 0% forever, basically, is what Japan is.
Yeah. 888-99-CHART is our number. 888-992-4278. It may be good for U.S. customers, but it has been taking a toll on mutual funds. How the cheap euro is eroding your investments. That's going to be one of our main talking points today, so I hope we can talk about that.
And that ties into our conference coming up.
Kind of. Mm-hmm. Bad reasons to making changes to your portfolio. I have a list of several bad reasons that people make changes that these are not good reasons to change your portfolio. How a bond portfolio can survive with higher interest rates. Because everybody's thinking, well, why do I want to be in bonds if interest rates go up? Because that means bond values go down. Well, it doesn't mean you abandon bonds. There's things you can do. And oil prices rebound to $57. I don't know if you saw that today, but it now it's rebounded to $57. That's a 2015 high. Will that help the drillers?
It should.
Well, no. Will it?
I mean, it should help their sale, their prices.
We're going to talk about that. Okay. We'll talk about that when we get into it. Those are the three things. Four things I would like to talk about. The Dow, the NASDAQ were up at the exact same price, 21 points today. The S&P was up 5. So this is right near, right at the highs.
Yeah, it was a very interesting session. We started off lower, chopped a little bit in the morning, rallied, had a really midday, just the market just popped up.
Yeah,
started a decent rally through pretty much till the end of the day, until the last about half hour, and then we sold off a decently. But like you said, still ended positively, so it was a modestly positive day.
The housing, new home sales were out today, and they were disappointing. Remember, just a couple of days ago, existing housing sales were really a surprise on the upside.
Yeah.
But new home sales were a surprise on the downside.
Yeah, and if you look at the ITB, the iShares U.S. Home Construction ETF, that was down about 1.5% or so. Actually, more than that, about 3%.
I didn't see why. I didn't get a chance to do much investigation as to why new home sales were down, because interest rates were low. It was in March, so kind of after the worst of the winter. And I got this feeling, but maybe I'm totally wrong, that was it because builders didn't have enough supply? Or is it just that there wasn't enough interest? And I would really like to know. I'm gonna find that out by tomorrow because I want to know for myself. But I'm not sure why. With a little brief paragraph or two I read about it, it didn't really tell us why. It just stated the facts, which maybe, I like facts. But
maybe I'll do a little research during the break and figure that out.
You may have questions about gold, about how changing interest rates will affect your portfolio. Maybe you're thinking about something else, 401k, IRA. Maybe you're thinking about investment properties. I don't know. Whatever it is financial, we want to talk about it. 888-99-CHART is how you can reach us right now. 888-992-4278. That's our number. You can reach us right now. We're going to go talk to BJ in Fremont. How you doing, BJ? Hello. Hello, BJ.
Hello.
BJ, how you doing?
Yeah, you there?
Yeah. Yes. We lost him. Okay, call us back, BJ. I know you want to talk about interest rates and bonds. So call us back and we'll talk about it. I don't know what your question was about that, but be happy to discuss it with you. How the cheap euro is hurting your investments. Justin, how is the cheap euro hurting our investments?
Well, the cheap euro is hurting your investments if you have investments in these markets in Europe. And, you know, many people do, and they probably should have a certain amount of exposure to foreign markets, and probably more now than we've probably would recommend in the recent past. And the reason it's hurting people's investments is because of the price of the euro is going down. And even though this, the QE, what's going on over there, is helping asset prices, and they're going up. And actually, the MSCI All Cap World X US Index is up 14.6% in local currency terms so far in the last year.
But what
that means is, but if you that's in local currency terms, meaning in euros, right?
Euros. Mm-hmm.
But if you say, okay, let's calculate in the loss or the decline in the euro, it's pretty much flat against the dollar. You're pretty much flat.
Okay, so my question is, every time I read something like this, that it always seems to be at the very worst time. So in other words, is this over with? Because this article is written.
Well, this article it was interesting. We were looking at this before the show. This article, it's a little older article, but it still makes sense because the dollar is still relatively strong. The euro is still relatively weak. But ever since the article came out, which is on March 12th, the dollar has stopped going down, or stopped going up, and the euro has stopped really going down against the dollar.
So it might already be... This is typical, by the way, this is from Money Magazine, by the way. When popular press articles come out and tell you what some bad news has happened, usually that's the end of the bad news. It's very often the end of the bad news. So you almost want to be a contrarian and go just the opposite way that they have. And there is a philosophy, you know, about
especially
that.
With, like you said, the Money Magazine. It's a very popular magazine. Remember, these magazines, these websites, they're about ratings and readership more than anything. They don't really care whether they're right or wrong. They just care whether you're going to read that particular article.
So they want to stress the shock value.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, look how bad this is. Look at this. Read this.
And so the big question is, should you hedge away the currency risk? So if you hedged away the currency risk in the euro, you would have made good money. And there are funds that do that, ETFs and mutual funds do that. We're going to show you some on Saturday. But it actually makes sense for bond funds to do it, but not for stock funds. And we'll tell you that why that is on Saturday.
Hedge funds, the big, massive hedge funds, they do. That's why they call them hedge funds. They hedge. It's easy to register for a Saturday Morning Wealth Conference. And attending is likely the best thing you'll do this weekend. So show up. Go to investtalk.com and sign up.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. Coming up on the next Invest Talk, worried about bond fund risks? Tips on using past performance, portfolio data, and yield to gauge your holdings' potential trouble spots. That's our talking point for Friday, April 24th. We hope you'll listen to that podcast.
888-99-CHIRP. Hey, BJ, you're back. How you doing, BJ?
I'm doing fine. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, thank you. Thanks for taking the call. My question is regarding the interest rate now. Since the interest rates are likely to go up, why anybody will invest in bonds at this point? Why bond prices are still stable and at a certain price?
Well,
why people are not pulling their money out of it?
Well, there are several reasons why. One is, if you buy the actual bonds or hold a maturity, it goes back to par, so you don't lose any money if you hold it. If you're buying bond funds, then the bond fund values probably will go down if interest rates go up.
But it also depends on what type of bond fund. So
exactly.
There's various levels of interest rate risk. You're talking about interest rate risk in relation to bonds. And bonds with longer duration, meaning they mature many years out, 10 plus years, they have a lot of interest rate risk. Bonds that, you know, get closer to, you know, zero in maturity rate, there's less and less interest rate risk. So it depends. And bonds, you know, they are a good diversifier for a portfolio.
What if the stock market goes down 20% and your bond fund won't go down 20% if the stock market goes down 20%?
Yes.
So
there's still a place for them. They're just, you have to understand the risks that are now ahead of us for the next many decades and interest rates that haven't been in the past 30 years because interest rates keep going down.
So there will be, BJ, they will be much less desirable. I agree with you. They will be. But there are reasons why you want to, and I'm going to talk about them a little bit deeper here during the show, but there are reasons and ways you can invest in bonds and bond funds that won't be such a bad impact and will help. Actually, you can make money still in them. I mean, you can't. Historically, they have not had the greatest returns. I mean, if you go back at the last 100 years, your last 30 years when interest rates went down all that time, yeah, they have much better returns.
I think I think you can't take bonds and paint it with a broad stroke that it all interest rates impact all bonds the same because they don't.
Okay, thanks, BJ. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Sam in San Jose. He wants to talk about capital gains. How you doing, Sam? Sam? Yellow. Sam?
Fine, thanks for taking my call, Steve. I have a question on long-term capital gains and the sale of real estate property.
Sure.
I was reading somewhere that if you are in the lower tax bracket after retirement, less than 15%, then you don't have any long-term capital gains. Is that true?
No, that's not true. If you're talking about property, and are we talking about property you own, your own property that you live in, or are you talking about rental property? Because there's different things. There's different capital gains treatment.
Rental property. The rental property.
Okay, so rental property, you're going to have to pay capital gains when you sell that property. And long-term means you have to own it longer than 12 months. And that means long-term is what? I think it's 20%. It could be 23.5% if you're rich. You know, they add on another 3.5% just recently for Obamacare. But, you're not going to be able to avoid long-term capital gains. But if it's a property you live in, and if you're married, I think it's the first $500,000 of capital gains you don't have to pay. If you're single, it's $250,000 in properties that you lived in. If they're rental properties, there might be rules about being older and, you know, in your retirement and not have to pay capital gains, but I don't remember ever reading anything like that. Justin, you?
Yeah, well, I think he's talking about if he's in the lowest tax bracket, you might be in that 15% category, but you won't get out of it completely. You're going to have to pay some taxes.
Yeah, you're going to have to pay it.
But, that's what I read somewhere. If you're less than 15% bracket and then your capital gain is zero. So I was kind of surprised.
I don't think so.
I've never heard that. Now, you know, we're not tax professionals. No. And the reason we say always talk to an accountant is because the tax laws always change. You know, new legislation that comes out. And only really accountants can keep up with the movements in that type of legislation. So I would check with an accountant. And if you need an accountant, call our office. We can get you in touch with one.
Yeah, CPAs. We only deal with CPAs. And Sam, I doubt it. You'll be able to get out of it completely, but there might be some rules. We'll just see. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
One last question is on dividends. If you are within the 15% tax bracket, will you get to be taxed 20% on dividends?
Well, dividends.
Yeah, they're at 20. They're at 20% now. Yeah. So if you're in that lowest tax bracket, I think there is, like you said, if you make too much money, you will go up. It'll be higher than 20%. But yeah, now it is 20%.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate the call.
And if it's short term, is that for long term? But short term, it's going to be based on your tax bracket.
Yeah, but
right?
But capital or dividends are always as long as they're qualified dividends, meaning not from mass limited partnership, they will be at that 20% tax rate.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Sean in New York. We only have a couple of minutes. How are you doing, Sean?
Hi, guys. Great show. I'm very well. My question is about the difference between certain index funds, let's say index funds that mirror the S&P 500, and also ETFs that do the same thing. Let's say Vanguard and Fidelity have index funds that both mirror S&P 500, right. And they're also ETFs like SPY, uh-huh. That are right. Supposedly do the same thing. So why would you buy an index fund that costs you money, there's an expense ratio, versus like ETFs that...
Gotcha. I get it. We'll pick up this after the break. We don't want to shortchange you. It's important to understand how to analyze fundamentals of a stock and also understand economic fundamentals that will affect business climate. We want to talk to you about that. We're going to talk about it on Invest Talk 101. So, Sean, you're still with us?
I'm here, yes.
Okay, your question is an index fund and an ETF that tracks index funds, both of these have costs associated with them, and are you asking what is the difference, or is there one better than the other? Is that what you're asking?
Pretty much. If both okay. of them, let's say both of them are mirroring S&P 500,
right.
Are they both supposed to be expected to have the same return?
They will actually have, if they're tracking the S&P 500, they will have the exact same returns except for the management fee inside them.
Yeah, they're called expense ratio. And yeah, I think, I'm not sure if you know this, but ETFs also have expense ratios. It's just because ETF doesn't mean it's a lack of expense ratio. It still has an expense ratio just like an index mutual fund would have.
Yeah, but ETFs generally, and I'm going to say this, generally have a lower expense ratio, but not always. For the index funds. So you really want to look at the expense ratio, and you wanted to get the cheapest one because there's no difference. They're both tracking the exact same thing. So always go with least expensive. And Vanguard has historically the least expensive expense ratios, just so you know.
Okay.
Okay?
And over a long term, let's say one expense ratio is 0.05, the other one is 0.1. Does it make a big difference over 10, 20 years or no?
Yes, it will make a big difference.
Oh, I see.
It will. Yes. It'd be, I don't know what it is, but it's that kind of disparity, it would be pretty big. Yes.
So why is the price different, like expense ratio would be different, when both are doing the same thing?
Well, it just depends what the pricing is, what the fund family thinks, and sometimes it's harder to execute the strategy in an ETF form versus a mutual fund form.
And maybe they want to make more money. How's that?
Yeah, well, that sounds reasonable.
Okay, Sean, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
It's important to understand how to analyze everything, everybody. We want to make sure you come to our conference. That's tomorrow. Not tomorrow. Day after tomorrow. Saturday morning, 9 to 12. We're going to help you understand analyzing foreign stocks versus domestic stocks, ETFs and foreign stocks, those kinds of things. Okay. Now, bad reasons to making changes to your portfolio. I'm sure if I ask Justin this, he doesn't know the reasons I've written down, but I bet you if I ask him, he could come up with a list of bad reasons for making changes. I made a list, and there was an article that made me start to think about it, and I took a couple of theirs. One is the market can't go up anymore. People think that it can't go up anymore, so I got to make changes. In other words, get out.
You want me to go another one that I hear? I don't know what you've written down.
Let me finish.
Well, I want to see if they match up.
Let me finish this one.
Okay, finish that one.
And the reason why you can't do that is because, do you remember Greenspan in 1998 said the market was irrational, exuberant, and the market didn't peak till 2000, 2 years later. What were you going to say, John?
Well, I was going to say, because it didn't do well the last year or 2 years, it hasn't done well, so I'm going to sell it.
No, that's a bad reason.
That's a bad reason. Is that on your list?
Not one of mine. No.
Not one of yours?
The next one I have is the Fed is going to raise rates, so I want to get out before that happens. No. Matter of fact, there's statistics to prove with rates going up does not necessarily correlate to a market going down or up. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't. It just means there's not, historically, it's not correlated. You don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
Another one. Market is overpriced. I need to get out. Market can stay overpriced, as we saw in the dot-com era, like I said before.
Yeah, and you can go. Markets can be more irrational than you think they can be.
Yep.
They get divorced from reality on the upside and the downside because markets are emotional. Why are markets emotional? Because markets are traded by human beings who are emotional beings. And we have herd mentalities. We have recency bias. Like I said just a minute ago, oh, it went down in the last year or two. I need to get out. Well, that's historically not the best time to be getting out.
And the last one I wrote down, but believe me, I could come up with more.
Yeah.
But the last one I wrote down, I can't lose money in cash, so I'll just wait till the market falls or pulls back or something. Well, we haven't had a good pullback since the summer of 2011.
4 years.
I mean, come on. You can't use these reasons to get out of the market. It's just not good enough reasons. I'm not saying you don't use reasons to get out of the market, but not these.
Yeah, you have to understand. You can't use emotion. A lot of these are, emotional.
Emotional
you have
based.
You have to make decisions based on numbers and facts.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. We're going to talk to Vic in San Jose. He wants to talk about Terra Nitrogen. Haven't talked about that stock in a long time. How you doing, Vic?
Pretty good. Hey, listen, Justin and Steve, thanks for taking my call. This Terra Nitrogen, I don't know what happened today, but it was was down pretty much to $130, I believe. Do you know what happened there? Or?
Well, let's see. Terra Nitrogen Company will be upgraded by... No, I don't see anything. In the quick headlines I'm looking at, I don't see any reason. Terra Nitrogen, everybody, is a company manufacturing fertilizers, including ammonia nitrate products, that kind of thing, for farmers to improve crop yield. It is a $2.4 billion company. It has been as high as 298 back in 2012, and today it's 131. Has a very high yield, 7.6%. Mm-hmm. Sales have not been very good the last couple of years. They've been falling.
And they fell 90% last quarter, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know how that could happen. They went from $168 million in revenue in 2013, in the last quarter, to $16 million in revenue,
yeah,
in the quarter, last quarter of 2014. So
that's something's odd there, Justin.
Very odd.
Yeah, man, that is like 10%.
Do you own this, Vic?
Yes, I do. And I saw this went down almost to $130, and I was wondering whether they came up with earning or.
I don't see it in the news. I mean, as I flip over here, I don't see it.
Yeah, I'm not seeing any major news either. Could be are earnings coming up?
That would be my guess.
Yeah,
earnings. That would be my guess, but
it might be moving pre-earnings as people are speculating.
Selling the rumor.
Yeah.
Because the new earnings are going to be bad before they actually come out. There's a rumor that they're going to be bad. Mm-hmm. It kind of lead me to believe that that's what it's about because it is earnings season.
This says that it's not going to report earnings till the 19th of next month.
Really? That's pretty far away.
So,
I'm sorry, Vic. I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah.
I don't know what
must have happened. Because it dropped quite a bit, though.
Yeah, that's a big drop.
By the way, I do have a suggestion about this capital gain thing.
Sure.
You're talking about the rule I know is called 2 out of 5 year rule, basically. And what that is when you have a rental property, when you rent it, you do have to pay. But if you move into the property
And live there two of the last 5 years?
2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2 out of 5 years they call. But if you live there 2 years and then sell it, then I don't think so you have to pay.
Well, you don't have to pay up to the $500,000 if you marry $250,000
right,
and
$250,000.
Yeah. Yeah. I've known of that. Yeah, that rule's pretty it's been around for a long time. So I'm sure people have done that. Did you think about doing it?
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because you sold all your property sales in
four. That's what I know.
So. Right, yeah. I sold them all. Thanks, Vic. Appreciate the call.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, that's why I asked them the previous caller. That's why I asked him, was this a rental unit or was this your own house? Because I wanted to get an idea, but I could have got more specific about how many has he lived in it. But Vestalk 101. How can we measure economic strength? How do you measure it? How can we? There are a few ways to calculate gross domestic product, or GDP, but the simplest calculation involves four factors: consumption, investment, government spending, and net exports. Net exports. The largest component of GDP in the U.S. is consumer consumption. The consumer. Our economy is driven by the consumer. Income trends, savings rates, wealth effect, personal balance sheets, confidence, all have effect what consumers do. So you got to watch that consumer. That's the most important part of our GDP, our economic strength. Also, the investment component has a lot to do with business confidence. Businesses go out and spend money on buildings and new projects, acquisitions, factory upgrades, equipment. When they feel confident, that means generally they're willing to spend, the economy expands. Government spending is fairly self-explanatory. I always, that's one of the, for me, that's one of the worst parts of figuring out GDP, because government spending is money that take out of consumers' pockets in the form of taxes, and it's usually inefficient, but it is still part of the economy.
Well, a lot of times, we're borrowing to spend as well.
Yeah, borrowing the money. In the long run, that's a zero-sum game. Yeah, it's not going to work. But in the short term, you can get stimulus. But you can't stimulus everywhere, all the time, forever. You can't. The final component has to do whether export or import. You know, when you export goods from the United States and import goods from the United States, if you export more than you import, that adds to our GDP. If you import more than you export, that detracts from our GDP.
And we've been a net importer for many decades.
Long time. Yeah. And now that our dollar's going up, imports are rising, our exports are falling. That detracts from our GDP.
Yep.
That's how you kind of, and this, believe me, we've given you very simple, broad concepts here, but that's how you keep track.
And with the slump in the oil patch, the investment component is starting to weaken as well, because a lot of these companies have been spending a lot of money on building rigs and the infrastructure to pump and move oil.
Think how many layoffs that involves.
Yeah. And think of all the equipment that was used to start these wells and operate these wells.
Even
it's not going to be used as much.
Yeah, even as simple as the pipes they don't need now.
Mm-hmm.
For every
so
well.
That's going to be the biggest drag. The export, the net exports is going to be the biggest drag in the near term. The consumption side, retail spending hasn't been as strong as people would.
And we're going to get new retail spending numbers next week for March. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
The strongest component of those four is government spending.
And that's scary.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's InvestTalk 101. Do you have a question about today's topic or any other topic, financial, give us a call. You can check in right now at 888-99-CHART.
If you'd like to see the investment programs offered by KPP Financial, just go to the Investments tab on investtalk.com. Dynamic growth, active management for optimum returns, balanced income, steady yield for those who like less risk, select growth and income program, hand-picked mutual funds for flexibility, strength, and diversity. And the 401k solution, bringing exceptional professional management to the masses. See these and the details on investtalk.com. Look for the Investments tab.
Hi, Steve. This is Dick from Sacramento. I've got you on podcast. I'm just wondering on the fundamentals now. On your show, you always mention that the stock is overpriced. I'm trying to figure out, how do you look at something like that is overpriced? I really cannot tell. But anyway, I would appreciate your information. I do enjoy your show. Thank you.
Well, welcome to one of the most difficult things in our industry, is to determine what is a proper price for a stock. It's not... It's because we, Justin and I, look at stocks day in, day out over the years, and we determine what is a fair market price for a stock based on its earnings, its growth, its return equity. There's all kinds of things that you want to put into it. But after years and years and years to look at, you kind of know the different industries and what they price things out based on their growth rate. I wish I could. There are simple ways to value a price, and there's very complex formulas to value a stock. But I don't think I can tell you right over the airways here how to determine the overpriced, underpriced of a stock, because it depends on so many different factors.
It depends, like you said, the industry. Certain industries trade at high P/E ratios, high multiples, because guess what? They have high margins, and then maybe they have high growth rates. And think of the technology sector. And then there's sectors that trade at low multiples because the margins are very, very slim. Retail, think of commodities, things like that. So it just really depends. When you're valuing a stock, the way I look at it most importantly is compared to others in the industry. That is the most important, because then you're comparing apples to apples as opposed to apples and oranges. If you're comparing a tech stock to a commodity stock, you're comparing apples to oranges. It doesn't make sense. And so that's the most important thing, is just make sure you're comparing them with their peers, and then you can get a sense whether they're over or undervalued.
So the direct answer to your question is you probably can't. It's very difficult to evaluate stocks. You kind of have to rely on an expert to help you with that. And even then, we're not always right. Don't think just because we said it's this value. Stocks can get overvalued and undervalued just like markets can. So, you know, we can just tell you what the fair value is, what it should be. Doesn't mean it has to be. We're coming up on the last segment of the program. Let's try to get your question in if we can. You can call us right now at 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. And we're going to talk about oil prices. They're at $57 right now. Does that help the drillers? We'll talk about that when we come back.
Good advice. Spread your money around. Stick to a well-thought-out plan for carefully divvying up your money so no single calamity will destroy your portfolio. Want to talk about it? 888-99-CHART is how to get through right now. Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. If you're an InvestTalk insider, then you already have access to our latest webinar, The Upside of Lower Oil Prices. It's the latest offering for InvestTalk insiders. Why not sign up yourself? It's free on InvestTalk.com.
888-992-4278. Now, you know, oil prices plunged, and they're now back to $57 a barrel. Now, that's not a huge price, but I think they got down to a low as, what, about $45 a barrel? And they're now back at $57. Now, I don't necessarily think they're going to stay at $57. They could pull back again. I'm not even talking about that. What I want to talk about, by the way, today is a 2015 high in oil prices. What I want to talk about is all the problems the drillers have and how the driller count has just collapsed, okay? Now that it's $57 a barrel, is it really going to help the drillers? Well, here's some arguments. Our total overproduction in oil right now is about 1 to 1.5 million barrels a day. That's the overproduction estimate. At previous oversupply points in history, the overproduction, surplus supply production, was about $10 million barrels a day. And we only are at 1.5. So it's not as much as we think it is, or it could be. Lower prices that we've had has now increased demand for oil. So the demand for oil is going up, while production is going down. And finally, drillers are finding ways to become much leaner and more efficient. So this is going to help them in the long run, in my opinion.
Yeah, there's been a lot of malinvestment, meaning poor investment, investments made in the oil patch, because oil prices were high. And, you know, if you made a bad investment, you still, even if the cost to extract it went up a little bit, it was higher than you had expected, you were still profitable. And that made a lot, made companies make a lot of bad investments and put a lot of resources into wells that weren't that efficient, weren't that productive. And now they're going to have to either shut some or, like you said, start actually thinking more strategically about which wells they do pump out of, how they get that stuff out of the ground, and they're going to be much more efficient. Their capital allocation is going to be much more efficient.
So if oil prices stay where they are or just don't collapse or just slowly rise, mm-hmm. I think drillers are going to be one of the beneficiaries here because they've already been beaten up. They've already took it in the shorts. They already have collapsed, and the weaker drillers are going to be gone. You don't have to worry about those.
There was one executive said by the end of the year he thinks half of shale companies will either be out of business or bought up.
Yep, I could see that. And what does that leave you with? It leaves you with the stronger ones, the healthy ones, the ones that can take advantage.
The ones that know really what they're doing.
Yeah. Now let's get back to work answering questions. Nadia called our Anytime line in San Ramon.
Hi. Actually, my question was regarding Netflix. I wanted to invest in the stock, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on its technicals. Thank you.
Okay, let's look at Netflix. I think everybody knows who Netflix is. And if you don't, well, gosh, I guess you don't watch TV. I mean, there's people, I have relatives that don't watch TV. So, I mean, that's possible. Anyways, Netflix has been, is trading at, what, $559 a share. It's growing 20 to 25% sales per quarter. Earnings in 2015 are going to take a big dip, down 50% plus, but then rebound 124% next year. And didn't they just come out with their numbers?
And it did really well. The subscriber growth was very good. That's why, especially outside the country, that's why it's, been doing well. My issue with them is just extremely expensive, 155 P ratio. Even if you go based on next year's earnings, projected to be $3.67. I mean, you're talking about about 30-40 P ratio.
Yeah, so you have to be willing to pay the top dollar for the stock. And it doesn't mean it won't go down. As we said earlier, things get overvalued and can stay overvalued.
And I think they're going to get a lot more competition from Amazon Prime, all these services that are coming, HBO Go, or HBO Now, I think is what they're calling it. So I
even think, Justin, that Time Warner and all the cable companies are going to offer different packages.
Yeah. I think Netflix is a good company. Long term, it's still going to stay around. But I think long term, these are not good prices to be invested in. Short term, it could keep going up, though.
Before we close for the hour, broaden your horizons. Don't limit your bargain hunting to the U.S. stocks. That's going to be our message here on our Saturday Morning Wealth Conference, April 25th. That's this Saturday. Register now at investtalk.com. I'm Portfolio Manager Steve Peasley with Justin Klein. And for everyone at KPP Financial, we thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.